Politics are to blame for the rising cost of college tuition, skyrocketing student debt, and a growing inability for Americans to take advantage of higher education, according to our guest this hour, the author of the book Degrees of Inequality. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. What do you think about the state of higher education? Is it accessible or not? Affordable or not? And by the way, are you still paying off your student loans? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Suzanne Mettler, professor of American Institutions at Cornell University and a fellow at the Century Foundation. She is the author of Degrees of Inequality: How the Politics of Higher Education Sabotaged the American Dream. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, good morning, Joy. I'm delighted to be with you.
So let's just generally, how have the politics of higher education sabotaged the American dream?
Well, to my mind, this is a really tragic development. In the middle of the 20th century in the United States, from the creation of the GI Bill for World War II veterans up through Pell Grants in 1972, the federal government was creating all of these landmark policies that gave student aid to more and more students and enabled them to become the first in their families to go to college. States were investing more than ever in developing their public universities and colleges. And through that, we had great success in dramatically increasing the percentage of college graduates in the United States. And those the impact of that was being felt across the income spectrum. But in the decades since then, we've done less well. We have more people going to college than ever, but the increases are particularly for those who grew up in families where they were already better off. They're much more likely to go to college. So the problem, to get to your, your question about what's gone wrong politically, the problem is that we have these existing policies. They're still on the books, but we have not maintained them well. We have not updated them and taken care to reform them if they've gone off track in various ways. And the reason for that is because we have such poor political dynamics these days with high partisan polarization in Washington, D.C., and another dynamic that I call plutocratic governance of lawmakers sometimes coming together across party to support vested interests and the affluent. So who's left out here is the majority of Americans who are not getting the same kind of opportunity for social mobility and for all of the other effects of higher education that we would hope to be providing.
So I want to follow up on a couple of things here. You're saying that the kids of college graduates are going to college, but most everybody else is not.
Yeah, you know, I started to, well, I wrote a book some years ago about the World War II GI Bill, and I would ask my students, my undergraduates, if they had had any relatives who'd used that law. And of course, most of them would say no, they were unaware of it. So then I would give them an assignment of, I would say, you know, when you're, I want you to this weekend call up your grandparents and ask them if there's any public policy that's ever had an impact on their lives. Well, they would come back having discovered that a good share of their grandparents had gone to college on the GI Bill and had been the first in their families to go to college. And there was a what I think is that we have this long-run impact of people whose relatives benefited in the middle of the 20th century. They're now the people who are able to go to college. They grow up in a higher socioeconomic status home, and the expectation is they're going to college, and their parents are able to help them to afford it. But it's everyone else, the other 75% of Americans, who are really being left behind. And they're trying to go to college. They'll enroll, but it's very hard for them to stay enrolled and to finish. And all too often, those who do end up with high student loan debt and in some cases worse off than if they'd never attended.
And that can happen to the kids of college graduates, too, and they'll be saddled with this debt. I mean, when I went to college, the bill was not all that much, and I didn't have to take out a lot of student loans. But my nephew is saddled with huge student loans, even though he went to a public-supported university of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. It's just way more expensive, and if you want to get a postgraduate degree, he got a law degree, it's a lot of money.
Yes, absolutely. Now, I mean, the highest student loan debt generally comes from people going on to get professional degrees and graduate degrees. And in that instance, arguably, those people are making an investment in their lives and they're going to be able to repay those loans. So I'm not so worried about them, but I am worried about the undergraduate who accumulates a high degree of student loan debt along the way. Particularly if they end up going to a school where their degree is not going to be so worthwhile once they complete it, and where they might have difficulty completing it because there's not enough student support, academic support, a good faculty to student ratio, and so on. This is particularly harmful for students who come from less advantaged backgrounds academically.
Thus the title, Degrees of Inequality?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. So what are some of the you're not, I know that you're not a fan of for-profit colleges. Tell us about why that's a problem.
Yeah. So the for-profit colleges, these used to be called trade schools or career colleges. And as recently as the early 1990s, they were only about 1-2% of all college students enrolled in them. But they've now gone up to 13%, so they've been growing dramatically. Many of these schools now offer 100% online degrees, and they do across states, so many of them are multi-state enterprises. Unfortunately, the outcomes of these schools are pretty poor. They recruit particularly low-income students and many people for whom they would be the first in their families to go to college. They're often people who are already working and they might have children and family responsibilities. And the for-profits have done a good job of reaching out to them and finding ways to accommodate them, such as by getting around the regular semester schedule and so many of the things that higher education generally has just done it the same way forever. They've broken out of that mold so that they could accommodate people who are non-traditional students. The problem is that they invest very little in the actual education of those students. They invest a lot in recruiting them, but once they've gotten these students with their student loan money, then their commitment to them seems to be quite poor. So the graduation rates are only 22%. But these students who don't graduate, who've enrolled and not graduated, have already taken out student loan debt to go to some semesters of these schools. And then even for those who do graduate, they have very high student loan debt. The median debt is $33,000. But often once they finish, even if they get the degree, they're not able to get a job that was any better than what they had previously in terms of what it pays. So then they're up the creek because here they have still a low-paying job, but now $33,000 in debt.
Yeah.
And so what we find is that within 3 years, 23% of them have defaulted on their loans. So for these people, they can really be at risk of financial ruin because student loan debt is a form of debt that you can't get rid of in bankruptcy. So it's really can become like an albatross around their necks. And this is really tragic. I mean, these schools are reaching out to exactly the people that we would hope, if they have the aspiration to get more education, to learn more, and to have more opportunities, that we would like to be able to allow that to happen. And yet, in fact, they have these hopes taken advantage of by these schools, and they can end up worse off.
Help us understand why Congress would, why our federal government would subsidize for-profit colleges like this when they're not helping their students?
Well, this has been a big puzzle to me, and I've really spent quite a bit of time trying to understand that question. So these days, these schools are permitted by law to receive up to 90% of their revenues from the federal government, or actually from just one public policy, and that is Title IV of the Higher Education Act of 1965. So this is student loans, the federal student loans, and Pell Grants. So this doesn't even count, that threshold doesn't even count what they can get in addition from the federal government through the GI Bill and other military-related education programs. So in other words, these schools are almost completely subsidized by government. And so the question then is, you know, why is that permitted? Why are they allowed to really, you know, exist because of taxpayer dollars and yet to serve students so poorly and to serve the public interest so poorly? So this was a puzzle to me. The problems with these schools are nothing new. They go way back to after the first GI Bill in the 1940s. Immediately, many of these schools emerged overnight. They were called trade schools then, and they took in a lot of veterans, and they seemed to exist just so that they could take advantage of the federal money. It was a business opportunity for people, so entrepreneurs took advantage of it. And at that point in time, lawmakers across the aisle recognized these problems, and so they stepped in and had lots of congressional investigations of what was going wrong. And when they created the next GI Bill for Korean War veterans, they reined in how much these schools would be able to get. The same kind of problem emerged again once these schools in the 1970s gained access to civilian student aid. Again, there were all sorts of problems that cropped up, and lawmakers, again, both Democrats and Republicans, began to take issue with that. And by the late 1980s, Congress was holding all sorts of hearings, and in 1992, there were various regulations enacted. But in the years since then, there's been deregulation by Congress several years of rather loose enforcement of existing regulations by the Department of Ed. And now in recent years, the Obama administration has been trying to enact regulations to rein in how much to hold these schools accountable if they're getting federal student aid, that they have to live up to certain standards for their students. They were trying to do that during the first term, produced ultimately very watered down rules, and then they were thrown out by a judge. So now they're trying yet again. But so the question is, why isn't Congress doing more? And what I learned is that there's been quite an about face. There's a different story for each party, but the two parties are complicit in this. But for the Republicans, as recently as the late 1980s and early 1990s, many of them took issue with the for-profits because they saw them as taking advantage of government money and really, you know, milking the federal government was the language they would use. And so people in the Reagan administration and during the George H.W. Bush administration, various Republicans were proposing various regulations. Now, you cannot find a Republican on Capitol Hill who does not support the for-profits. I think as partisan polarization has grown, the party decided that they wanted to champion this sector of education, of higher education, which they see as private, and they've all lined up together because under a polarized political environment, you get much more teamwork of, you know, a whole, if the leaders of a party embrace something, then everyone else steps in line. So I think that explains what's going on for the GOP. For the Democrats, there have long been Democrats who championed the for-profits because they see them as helping low-income people, and also because they are scattered in congressional districts throughout the country, and lawmakers are often, you know, trying to defend the ones in their own district. So still to this day, you have many Democrats in the House that really support them. And the industry has done a lot of lobbying, and they've hired lobbyists who are former Democratic lawmakers and staffers from Capitol Hill, so that they have deliberately reached out to Democrats and tried to recruit them. So through this two-pronged approach of polarization, bringing the Republicans on board, and what I'm calling plutocratic governance, the Democrats on board, they've had a winning coalition in the House of Representatives.
We are talking with Suzanne Mettler. She is author of Degrees of Inequality, How the Politics of Higher Education Sabotaged the American Dream. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with our guest, the author of Degrees of Inequality, How the Politics of Higher Education Sabotaged the American Dream, talking about the politics of higher education and how that's being blamed for the rising cost of college tuition, skyrocketing student debt, and a growing inability for Americans to take advantage of higher education. And we welcome your questions and your own experiences for our guest, Suzanne Mettler, who is a professor of American institutions at Cornell University. Chris in Wisconsin Dells is with us first. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. It's going to warm up. It really is.
I hope so.
It really is. And you're not responsible for the snowstorm up north, but I really appreciate the fact that you tried to take responsibility for it. Anyway, I have what has been called probably the worst case in the history of the 20th century in America, and I'm going to try and keep this as succinct as possible, but it's a very long story. I was a major scholar at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. I was supposed to get the premier fellowship in the Center for 20th Century Studies, which is a think tank there. And I come from a working class family. My generation was the first one to go to college. I borrowed $15,000 to go to school, and I worked pretty much full time throughout the course of my undergraduate education. When I was a senior, I filed civil rights complaints on the basis of sexual harassment against a bunch of professors in the UWM art department. And the first thing that got yanked was my fellowship.
Well, you know what, Chris? This sounds like it's getting into a very controversial situation for you personally. I'm not sure this goes to the broader question of what we're talking about today. I thought you wanted to talk about the privatization of higher education.
I do, because that's where the money came from to do this to me. And it's controversial, but it was in the newspapers, all over the newspaper.
I'm sorry, Chris. You're going to bring up a very personal story about lawsuits and people we don't know about, and I think it's too involved for this discussion. However, she wanted to say that privatization of higher education is at the root of all of this, Suzanne Mettler, and it seems to me you would tend to agree with that.
Yes, that's right. So one of the biggest problems that we're facing in higher ed today, and why there's so much rising inequality coming out of the system, is that the states have really scaled back on their investment. Now, 73% of American college students still attend public universities and colleges, and these are the institutions that in the middle of the 20th century were providing the greatest ladder to opportunity. But what has happened in the last couple of decades is that states are faced with all sorts of competing demands fiscally, and higher education has gotten the short end of the stick. It's the largest discretionary item in most state budgets. And so while states have been putting more into Medicaid and K-12 education and incarceration and so on, they've not been investing in higher ed. And meanwhile, the cost of higher ed has gone up. So what the colleges and universities have done in order to pay the bills has been to charge more of students. And so students and their families are paying much more in tuition than in the past. So the investment that states make per student on average across the United States has diminished by 26% in real terms from 1990 to 2010. And therefore, tuition has increased, and it's gone up by 113%. And the other problem, and the guest mentioned that in going through college, she was both borrowing and working. Students are doing that more than ever. They're borrowing more than ever, and they're working more than ever in order to be able to pay the bills. And we find that this is really detrimental to college graduation rates when students have to drop out because they can't manage to be students and to be working full-time. And these universities are also cutting back on the kind of student support they're able to offer. They're pushing students into more online classes. Classes have grown bigger. And all of these things hurt college graduation rates. So it's a huge problem. And I think, calling this the privatization of public sector universities and colleges does capture those sorts of trends, and it's really troubling.
Well, I know that you're not going to know the ins and outs specifically about what's going on for Wisconsin, but generally, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker is proposing another tuition freeze for the University of Wisconsin system. He wants the UW system to continue a tuition freeze that was enacted in the last budget after I think it was found that the UW had some reserves. And what about cutting back on state public support of universities and freezing tuition?
Well, it's just a problem because we have to be able to pay our bills somehow. The public sector universities and colleges are still the best deal around in higher education. If you look at the cost of private nonprofits, they're considerably more, and so are the for-profit colleges. One of the things that's really tragic is that often students will attend a for-profit because they're heavily recruited to it when they could be going to a public university or college and paying much less there. So that has made these schools really accessible. So they've already been trying hard to keep their costs down. So if they're put in a situation where they're both getting less from the state and they can't raise tuition, then there's real worries about quality. And there's concerns about the number of students in the classroom and how much student support there's going to be and how much of a student's classes are actually going to be online rather than meeting face-to-face with a professor and engaging with other students, which is, for myself as a professor, I'm pretty partial to thinking that that's where the real learning happens. Or certainly we need to keep finding ways to use online education where it's useful, but our enthusiasm for that has been way out ahead of our understanding of the best uses of that approach, and too often it's being used just for cost savings.
Yeah. Let's go to Randy in Madison next. Hello, Randy.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
Good. I don't have enough information about the schools that are private, but I do have some thoughts as far as the tuition. For all colleges, universities, including trade schools, the tuitions need to be frozen for a while. I don't know how long. In fact, I think there would be space, there would be ways for them to go back in time to freeze them at earlier tuition hikes. The professors do not need to get and should not get the type of raises because they deserve that from getting their PhD or anything.
Okay, Randy, let me just say, you just said that, professors don't deserve raises. How about the argument that, for example, professors in Wisconsin make less money than the rest of the Big Ten or 11 or however many it is now?
Is that true?
Well, anyway, go on. What if that were the case?
Well, I'm not going to say that they shouldn't deserve raises, but there's got to be other ways for them to get raises throughout the system.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess what Randy's saying is reduce tuition, freeze tuition. It's just, I think what he's saying is it's not affordable still for the average working class person to go to school, and thinks that there's probably some fat to trim at even public universities. Suzanne.
You know, if you look at this in historical perspective, what's really striking to me is that going all the way back to, you know, the revolutionary period in the United States, soon after the American founding, we've had public policies that have helped to subsidize the cost of higher education. And this began with the Northwest Ordinance, and then in the middle of the 20th century, the land-grant colleges like the University of Wisconsin were established through the Morrill Act. So government has always seen it as being in the public interest to try to help people get college degrees. And in the 20th century, we made them much more widely accessible. So, you know, I think that it's true that we need to try to rein in what students have to pay to attend college. And so I'm in agreement with the caller on that sentiment. But the bills have to be paid somewhere if you're going to offer a quality product to students. And so that's where government needs to be able to step up and to do that providing. And these days, the federal government recently has increased once again what it is giving in federal student aid, but states need to do their part as well. And so what I really see as the downfall most recently is in the state commitment. And, you know, for states, this means investing in their workforce, in the ability to have the kind of the innovation and creativity that will drive economic development going forward, as well as promoting the development of a leadership group and real civic involvement among citizens.
Is there too much of a push, though, that you have to go to get a four-year degree in order to pursue the American dream?
Well, you know, I think that sometimes the position I'm taking might be parodied as, you know, college for all. And I'm not saying that. I don't think everyone needs to go to college, should go to college, wants to go to college. But anyone who wants to should be able to go to college. And a person is going to be much better off with a two-year college degree than with just a high school degree in terms of the kinds of job opportunities and pay that they're going to have subsequently. And they're going to be better off with a four-year degree than a two-year degree. So people need to choose the level that suits them appropriately. But for a person who really wants to learn and who really has that yearning for advanced education, I think we as a society need to be making that possible, and it's very much an American tradition to do that. And it's what we've been losing the ability to do in recent years.
Yeah, here's something that I've been wondering. I mean, Wisconsin's not alone in that. We have, you know, you have technical colleges, and we have the two-year University of Wisconsin campuses, the 4 years, a system all over the state of Wisconsin, practically more than one in every region of the state. Why in the world, why aren't students going to these institutions and instead going to the for-profit places that are going to give them a degree that's not going to get them a job and saddle them with that?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a great puzzle. Well, it seems to be a situation of the for-profits working very hard at recruitment, and they do recruitment the way any company would that's trying to make a profit, selling timeshare, condos or what have you. That's how they approach it. Whereas the other more traditional colleges and universities don't engage in that kind of recruitment. And often the people being recruited are individuals who come from families and maybe even communities where no one else has gone to college. So they're not informed consumers. So the problem is you have real information asymmetry of people being recruited. And to them, they're being recruited to a for-profit, and they think it's a college just like any other college. And they can get into it before they begin to realize that the quality of the degree is not as high as they expected and the cost is higher than they had expected, and then they're really in a bad situation. So it's that kind of lack of information that's really problematic.
Samuel in Milwaukee is with us. Hi, Samuel. You're on the air.
How are you doing today, ma'am?
Good. What's your question or comment?
Yes, ma'am. So I am, a first-generation GI Bill recipient. My grandfather served in Korea, but he had already gone to college. And I agree with most of the policy information that the guest is talking about. The original GI Bill created a boom in household college degrees, which the immediate benefit to that was a higher increased level of involvement from parents outside of school in their children's education. So you started having parents who had a higher level of education supplementing their kids' instruction at school. And I think one of the main problems is a lack of below high school or below college education on finance and industry needs and all that kind of stuff. There's a lot of students who show up unprepared for college, and a lot of for-profit schools have started offering easy degree plans to compensate for that, where they still get the same amount of tuition, the same amount of money, but kids are leaving with a social organization degree that, while was easy enough for someone who has issues with reading or writing or math to accomplish, is an unemployable degree. Part of the problem, I think, is the rush to avoid, social inclusion issues has put kids who are already several steps behind, because there hasn't been a college degree standard in their family or a higher education standard. It rushes them into a situation they're unprepared for, and they don't understand the long-term effects it'll have on their life. And high schools still, somehow to this day, don't have financial planning, don't talk about industry projections, job projections. Because
Samuel, thank you very much for all of your insight there. Suzanne, he's on the right track. In some ways, you talked about that earlier, about getting a degree that wasn't worth anything, but also students were dropping out and not getting degrees in these for-profit colleges.
Yes, that's right. And Samuel, thank you so much for your comments. And I'm really happy to speak with someone who's a GI Bill beneficiary. I've had a lot of interest in the original GI Bill and all the subsequent GI Bills. And I think one of our great accomplishments of recent years was the new post 9/11 GI Bill, although we could talk more about that in a few minutes. Unfortunately, too much of that is being used for students to attend the for-profit colleges where the outcomes are so poor. But I agree with where I think Samuel is going, is that, today we have this lack of intergenerational mobility in the United States. There are scholars who have found that other countries have really pulled ahead of the United States in the mobility between generations, or ability to, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Today, it's very hard for people who are growing up in a family where no one has gone to college to be able to, if they have the aspiration to do so, to go to college and to really enjoy a better socioeconomic standard later in life than they had growing up, whereas that kind of thing was common in the middle of the 20th century for people to make those leaps. And I think that there are many ways we need to address this. One is that, and probably the most obvious, is financial, because the main reason why students drop out of college is that they can't pay the bills and they're working too much to try to stay enrolled. But then Samuel is also pointing to some other things, and that is that we need better information for students and guidance along the way. There's a lot to navigate for young people as they're trying to figure out where should they go to college and what makes sense, which kinds of institutions will serve them well. And I think that we probably could be doing much more in terms of providing college guidance in high schools, particularly high schools where less advantaged students are likely to be attending, that we ought to be doing a lot more of that as well.
Talking with Suzanne Mettler, she is the author of Degrees of Inequality, How the Politics of Higher Education Sabotaged the American Dream. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Julie Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, talking about the politics of higher education and how our guest says it is sabotaging the American dream. We're talking with Suzanne Mettler, who is the author of Degrees of Inequality. Well, as I mentioned, coming up on point, the show that follows this one, Suzanne Mettler talking about the ins and outs of financial aid. Talk a little bit about the financial aid that is involved in the problem described in your book. We still do have GI bills. We still do have Pell grants. What's the problem?
Well, the big problem has been that policies have not been effectively maintained by lawmakers over the last few decades. So Pell grants were created in the 1970s and were really helping low-income people to go to college. At that point in time, a Pell grant had the purchasing power of covering almost 80% of the cost of tuition, fees, room, and board at the average four-year public university or college. And since that time, it's diminished in real value, so it now covers just over 30% of the cost of those same costs. And part of the problem is that tuition has gone up dramatically in real terms since that time. The other problem was that for a long time, the Pell grants were falling behind and lawmakers were not increasing them annually, so they were even falling behind the value of inflation. So meanwhile, that left students to make up the difference borrowing more. And it was much easier for lawmakers to agree to let more students borrow more money than it was to increase grant levels. That's been politically difficult. And so they really fell behind. Now, in recent years, the Pell grants have been improved somewhat. They're still, as I said, only, you know, about cover a little over 30% of the cost of attending college at a public university. We've improved the GI Bill recently, creating the post-9/11 GI Bill. But then the problem becomes that we are, as a nation, we're spending $1 in $4 toward these for-profit colleges, and their outcomes are so poor. There's really a crunch as well when you look at the cost of college going up more quickly than financial aid. And so families can hardly make up the difference. The other thing that's been done over the last couple of decades is putting more tuition relief into the tax code. And this Clinton was the first president to sign these kinds of things into law. They've been increased by each president since then. But the problem with these is that they don't really expand access to college, because the way they're delivered is long after someone is enrolled and long after tuition is paid. And so economists who study them find that, in fact, they're an extra perk to people who would go to college anyway, but they don't help to expand access to college.
Let's go to another caller, Jim and Marinette. Hi, Jim.
Hi. An incentive for going to college, I think, like California, if you're a resident, you have to be a resident for a number of years, you don't have to pay to go to state colleges. Why can they do that and we can't? I mean, I realize their taxes are higher, but they're not that much higher than ours. So how can they get away with that and we can't?
Interestingly, a pair of University of Wisconsin-Madison professors are proposing making the first 2 years of college free for students to prevent people from dropping off and to reduce the overall debt load. What about this idea here in Wisconsin, or just overall? Why can't we offer students an education at our public schools tuition free?
Well, I think it's an idea that we really need to be considering very carefully as a country, because if you think about, you know, the future, what better investment can we be making than in education, both K-12 and higher ed, to really invest in citizens so that they will be able to help grow the economy in the future and to participate in civic life in a way that enriches American democracy. I think it's, you know, that these kinds of plans really need to be considered carefully. And you're right, California has had a tradition of doing this. It's very challenging for California these days, and all states are facing these real trade-offs between the various other commitments that they have, these other growing areas that are mandatory spending of Medicaid and so on. It really means we need to step back and think about our priorities as a society. I mean, to me, it means that if our health care costs are growing and that is impinging upon higher ed investment, we really need to take seriously how to do cost control for health care and to find ways to, you know, have the extra investment for higher ed. We've also had rising economic inequality in the United States, and I think that our tax system has not kept pace with that. So when you look at revenues across states, they've been flat over the past decade. Many Americans cannot afford to be paying more because incomes have really stagnated. But there are some who can. And arguably, we need to be finding ways to be raising revenues among those who can afford it so that we can invest more in the next generation for the sake of the country, for the sake of everyone.
Well, what's the hope of that happening? Are you optimistic that the politics will shift and will be moving toward free higher education system?
Well, so far, as I talk to people who've been reading my book, I am hearing from people that it's depressing. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that folks come away from the book thinking, well, there's real reason for hope. The hope that I take is when I look across American history, I'm very inspired by the fact that we have time and again committed ourselves to promoting education, and we've done so for the public interest. And I think that there's a lot of hope to be taken from our own historic examples, and that it's time for a real wake-up call, because right now I think that politically we're going in a very bad situation, and that we need to regroup and recommit ourselves to greater priorities.
Helene in West Bend is with us. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm going back to the 1960s because I'm old. Yep. And at that time, I was the first graduate from a university in my family. Parents went to the sixth grade. I graduated with no debt. My parents, family members helped, and I worked summers in a factory. It was during that time of Sputnik when everybody was being pushed to get a college degree, because that was so important. And I remember sitting in freshman English reading an article called How to Write Like a Social Scientist. And it, too, was exposing this push for everyone needed to have a college degree, a four-year degree, not vocational school, not apprenticeships. It was all about getting that four-year degree, but not specifying what that degree was going to be in. So all of a sudden, there were these financial aid-type packages that were put in place. You could take out loans, and that's where the people fell into the trap. And in my view, there's a parallel happening in the K-12 with the voucher schools. And going, it's like trying to even destroy our lower-level education.
Yeah.
What happened was many of the students going to the university were taking courses that had nothing to do with Sputnik or we were looking down on the vocational schools, and they were pretty much deserted.
Thank you very much, Helene. So are we ignoring our vocational colleges, the technical colleges, or apprenticeships and other ways for people to pursue the American dream, Suzanne?
Well, that's interesting. So it is the case that for the caller going to college in the 1960s, I can imagine that there was that feeling about it. And at that point in time, the new civilian student aid that came about through the National Defense Education Act that was really kind of Sputnik-inspired, and then the Higher Education Act of 1965, it was only for traditional colleges and universities. And then in the early 70s, it was expanded so that it could also go for vocational programs, which, you know, are today have turned into these for-profit colleges, but they were the trade schools for a long period of time. I think the spirit of including those schools in federal financial aid was absolutely right, and the caller would probably agree that that was providing more people with opportunities to get advanced education, not necessarily college. For some people, college is the right way to go. For other people, vocational training is the right way to go. The problem is that we have not effectively monitored these schools, which happen to operate in a different way than traditional colleges, which are nonprofit or public and therefore nonprofit. So the public universities and colleges, if they make extra revenue, for example, they are committed to reinvesting that in their educational mission. But unfortunately, these schools that are supposed to be serving people who are trying to acquire skills, like vocational skills, happen to have a for-profit model. And over the past 15 or 20 years, the largest of them have become publicly traded on Wall Street. So their orientation is their top priority is making profits for their shareholders and for their top managers. It's not this broader education of people who would like to be involved in trades and in skills. So I'm afraid that while the ambition to provide that kind of training is a wonderful one, it's not happening as effectively as it ought to be because it's been combined with this for-profit model.
Darlene on Facebook says, maybe all higher education institutions should have tuition regulated and also the salaries of those who work in those institutions, just like everyone has been recommending for the healthcare system. Education, just like healthcare, has become too expensive and should be totally regulated so anyone can afford access. How about that?
Well, I absolutely agree that both healthcare and education are basic human rights, and that as a developed society, we need to be seriously looking at how we can make these things available across the board. I think we need to figure out the effective way of doing that, and cost controls are probably not it, but that there are constructive ways to do that. Economists will say that the cost of skilled labor goes up because those skills are in demand, and that explains part of why both healthcare and education, the costs go up over time. We still don't have real clear answers about why this is happening in higher ed, because faculty salaries have actually been pretty flat for some time. In fact, it seems to be that we have more administrators, and that's where a lot of the cost is going. Now, some of the reason for increased administrators is to try to help students who are less advantaged to graduate by providing more student support services and so on. But some of it is probably not for those purposes. And so it may be really time to rein in some of that excess administration.
And we'll leave it there for now because we're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us.
I've really enjoyed it, Joy. Thank you so much.
Suzanne Mettler, author of Degrees of Inequality, How the Politics of Higher Education Sabotage the American Dream. Thanks to Christy Taylor and to Bill Martins for producing and directing this program. This is the Ideas Network.